If you hadn't withdrawn them, it would have worked, I tell you. It wouldn't be like this. Don't accuse me. We can't be guilty, all of us, for centuries. We can't be so totally wrong. We're not to be damned. We had no choice. There is no other way to live on Earth. Why don't you answer me? What are you seeing? Are you thinking of that speech you made? I don't want to think of it. It was only logic. One can't live by logic. Do you hear me? Don't look at me. You're asking the impossible. Men can't exist your way. You permit no moments of weakness. You don't allow for human frailties or human feelings. What do you want of us? Rationality 24 hours a day, with no loophole, no rest, no escape? Don't look at me, goddamn you. I'm not afraid of you any longer. Do you hear me? I am not afraid. Who are you to blame me, you miserable failure? Here's where your road has brought you. Here you are, caught, helpless, under guard, to be killed by those brutes at any moment. And you dare to accuse me of being impractical? Oh, yes, you're going to be killed. You won't win. You can't be allowed to win. You are the man who has to be destroyed. Dr. Stadler's gasp was a muffled scream, as if the immobility of the figure on the windowsill had served as a silent reflector and had suddenly made him see the full meaning of his own words. No, moaned Dr. Stadler, moving his head from side to side to escape the unmoving green eyes. No, no, no. Galt's voice had the same unbending austerity as his eyes. You have said everything I wanted to say to you. Dr. Stadler banged his fists against the door. When it was opened, he ran out of the room. For 3 days, no one entered Galt's suite except the guards who brought his meals. Early on the evening of the fourth day, the door opened to admit Chick Morrison with two companions. Chick Morrison was dressed in dinner clothes, and his smile was nervous, but a shade more confident than usual. One of his companions was a valet. The other was a muscular man whose face seemed to clash with his tuxedo. It was a stony face with sleepy eyelids, pale darting eyes, and a prize fighter's broken nose. His skull was shaved except for a patch of faded blonde curls on top. He kept his right hand in the pocket of his trousers. "You will please dress, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison persuasively, pointing to the door of the bedroom, where a closet had been filled with expensive garments which Galt had not chosen to wear. "You will please put on your dinner clothes." He added, "This is an order, Mr. Galt." Galt walked silently into the bedroom. The three men followed. Chick Morrison sat on the edge of a chair, starting and discarding one cigarette after another. The valet went through too many, too courteous motions, helping Galt to dress, handing him his shirt studs, holding his coat. The muscular man stood in a corner, his hand in his pocket. No one said a word. "You will please cooperate, Mr. Galt," said Chick Morrison when Galt was ready and indicated the door with a courtly gesture of invitation to proceed. So swiftly that no one could catch the motion of his hand, the muscular man was holding Galt's arm and pressing an invisible gun against his ribs. "Don't make any false moves," he said in an expressionless voice. "I never do," said Galt. Chick Morrison opened the door. The valet stayed behind. The three figures in dinner clothes walked silently down the hall to the elevator. They remained silent in the elevator, the clicks of the flashing numbers above the door marking their downward progress. The elevator stopped on the mezzanine floor. Two armed soldiers preceded them, and two others followed as they walked through the long, dim corridors. The corridors were deserted except for armed sentinels posted at the turns. The muscular man's right arm was linked to Galt's left. The gun remained invisible to any possible observer. Galt felt the small pressure of the muzzle against his side. The pressure was expertly maintained, not to be felt as an impediment, and not to be forgotten for a moment. The corridor led to a wide, closed doorway. The soldiers seemed to melt away into the shadows when Chick Morrison's hand touched the doorknob. It was his hand that opened the door, but the sudden contrast of light and sound made it seem as if the door were flung open by an explosion. The light came from 300 bulbs in the blazing chandeliers of the grand ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel. The sound was the applause of 500 people. Chick Morrison led the way to the speaker's table raised on a platform above the tables filling the room. The people seemed to know without announcement that of the two figures following him, it was the tall, slender man with the gold-copper hair that they were applauding. His face had the same quality as the voice they had heard on the radio, calm, confident, and out of reach. The seat reserved for Galt was the place of honor in the center of the long table, with Mr. Thompson waiting for him at his right and the muscular man slipping skillfully into the seat at his left, not relinquishing his arm or the pressure of the muzzle. The jewels on the naked shoulders of women carried the glitter of the chandeliers to the shadows of the tables crowded against the distant walls. The severe black and white of the men's figures rescued the room's style of solemnly regal luxury from the discordant slashes made by news cameras, microphones, and a dormant array of television equipment. The crowd was on its feet, applauding. Mr. Thompson was smiling and watching Galt's face with the eager, anxious look of an adult waiting for a child's reaction to a spectacularly generous gift. Galt sat facing the ovation, neither ignoring it nor responding. "The applause you are hearing," a radio announcer was yelling into a microphone in a corner of the room, "is in greeting to John Galt, who has just taken his place at the speaker's table. Yes, my friends, John Galt in person, as those of you who can find a television set will have chance to see for yourself in a short while." "I must remember where I am," thought Dagny, clenching her fists under the tablecloth in the obscurity of a side table. It was hard to maintain a sense of double reality in the presence of Galt, 30 feet away from her. She felt that no danger or pain could exist in the world so long as she could see his face, and, simultaneously, an icy terror when she looked at those who held him in their power, when she remembered the blind irrationality of the event they were staging. She fought to keep her facial muscles rigid, not to betray herself by a smile of happiness or by a scream of panic. She wondered how his eyes had been able to find her in that crowd. She had seen the brief pause of his glance, which no one else could notice. The glance had been more than a kiss. It had been a handshake of approval and support. He did not glance again in her direction. She could not force herself to look away. It was startling to see him in evening clothes, and more startling still that he wore them so naturally. He made them look like a work uniform of honor. His figure suggested the kind of banquet in the days of a distant past where he would have been receiving an industrial award. Celebrations, she remembered her own words with a stab of longing, should be only for those who have something to celebrate. She turned away. She struggled not to look at him too often, not to attract the attention of her companions. She had been placed at a table prominent enough to display her to the assembly, but obscure enough to keep her out of the line of Galt's sight, along with those who had incurred Galt's disfavor, with Dr. Ferris and Eugene Lawson. Her brother Jim, she noted, had been placed closer to the platform. She could see his sullen face among the nervous figures of Tinky Holloway, Fred Kinnon, Dr. Simon Pritchett. The tortured faces strung out above the speaker's table were not succeeding in their efforts to hide that they looked like men enduring an ordeal. The calm of Galt's face seemed radiant among them. She wondered who was prisoner here and who was master. Her glance moved slowly down the lineup of his table. Mr. Thompson, Wesley Mouch, Chick Morrison, some generals, some members of the legislature, and, preposterously, Mr. Moen, chosen as a bribe to Galt, as a symbol of big business. She glanced about the room, looking for the face of Dr. Stadler. He was not present. The voices filling the room were like a fever chart, she thought. They kept darting too high and collapsing into patches of silence. The occasional spurts of someone's laughter broke off, incompleted, and attracted the shuddering turn of the heads at the neighboring tables. The faces were drawn and twisted by the most obvious and least dignified form of tension, by forced smiles. These people, she thought, knew, not by means of their reason, but by means of their panic, that this banquet was the ultimate climax and the naked essence of their world. They knew that neither their god nor their guns could make this celebration mean what they were struggling to pretend it meant. She could not swallow the food that was placed before her. Her throat seemed closed by a rigid convulsion. She noticed that the others at her table were also merely pretending to eat. Dr. Ferris was the only one whose appetite seemed unaffected. When she saw a slush of ice cream in a crystal bowl before her, she noticed the sudden silence of the room and heard the screeching of the television machinery being dragged forward for action. Now, she thought, with a sinking sense of expectation, and knew that the same question mark was on every mind in the room. They were all staring at Galt. His face did not move or change. No one had to call for silence when Mr. Thompson waved to an announcer. The room did not seem to breathe. "Fellow citizens," the announcer cried into a microphone, "of this country and of any other that's able to listen, from the grand ballroom of the Wayne Falkland Hotel in New York City, we are bringing you the inauguration of the John Galt Plan." A rectangle of tensely bluish light appeared on the wall behind the speaker's table, a television screen to project for the guests the images which the country was now to see. "The John Galt Plan for Peace, Prosperity, and Profit," cried the announcer, while a shivering picture of the ballroom sprang into view on the screen. "The dawn of a new age, the product of a harmonious collaboration between the humanitarian spirit of our leaders and the scientific genius of John Galt. If your faith in the future has been undermined by vicious rumors, you may now see for yourself our happily united family of leadership. Ladies and gentlemen," as the television camera swooped down to the speaker's table and the stupefied face of Mr. Moen filled the screen, "Mr. Horace Busby Moen, the American industrialist." The camera moved to an aged collection of facial muscles shaped in imitation of a smile. "General of the Army Whittington S. Thorpe." The camera, like an eye at a police lineup, moved from face to scarred face, scarred by the ravages of fear, of evasion, of despair, of uncertainty, of self-loathing, of guilt. "Majority Leader of the National Legislature, Mr. Lucien Phelps." "Mr. Wesley Mouch." "Mr. Thompson." The camera paused on Mr. Thompson. He gave a big grin to the nation, then turned and looked off-screen to his left, with an air of triumphant expectancy. "Ladies and gentlemen," the announcer said solemnly, "John Galt." "Good God," thought Dagny, "what are they doing?" From the screen, the face of John Galt was looking at the nation, the face without pain or fear or guilt, implacable by virtue of serenity, invulnerable by virtue of self-esteem. "This face," she thought, "among those others? Whatever it is that they're planning," she thought, "it's undone. Nothing more can or has to be said. There's the product of one code and of the other. There's the choice, and whoever is human will know it." "Mr. Galt's personal secretary," said the announcer, while the camera blurred hastily past the next face and went on. "Mr. Clarence Chick Morrison. Admiral Homer Dolly. Mr.—" She looked at the faces around her, wondering, did they see the contrast? Did they know it? Did they see him? Did they want him to be real? "This banquet," said Chick Morrison, who had taken over as master of ceremonies, "is in honor of the greatest figure of our time, the ablest producer, the man of the know-how, the new leader of our economy, John Galt. If you have heard his extraordinary radio speech, you can have no doubt that he can make things work. Now he is here to tell you that he will make them work for you. If you have been misled by those old-fashioned extremists who claimed that he would never join us, that no merger is possible between his way of life and ours, that it's either one or the other, tonight's event will prove to you that anything can be reconciled and united. Once they have seen him, thought Dagny, can they wish to look at anybody else? Once they know that he is possible, that this is what man can be, what else can they want to seek? Can they now feel any desire except to achieve in their souls what he has achieved in his? Or are they going to be stopped by the fact that the Mouches, the Morrisons, the Thompsons of the world had not chosen to achieve it? Are they going to regard the Mouches as the human and him as the impossible? The camera was roving over the ballroom, flashing to the screen and to the country the faces of the prominent guests, the faces of the tensely watchful leaders, and, once in a while, the face of John Galt. He looked as if his perceptive eyes were studying the men outside this room, the men who were seeing him across the country. One could not tell whether he was listening. No reaction altered the composure of his face. "I am proud to pay tribute tonight," said the leader of the legislature, the next speaker, "to the greatest economic organizer the world has ever discovered, the most gifted administrator, the most brilliant planner, John Galt, the man who will save us. I am here to thank him in the name of the people." This, thought Dagny, with a sickened amusement, was the spectacle of the sincerity of the dishonest. The most fraudulent part of the fraud was that they meant it. They were offering Galt the best that their view of existence could offer. They were trying to tempt him with that which was their dream of life's highest fulfillment. This spread of mindless adulation, the unreality of this enormous pretense, approval without standards, tribute without content, honor without causes, admiration without reasons, love without a code of values. "We have discarded all our petty differences," Wesley Mouch was now saying into the microphone. "All partisan opinions, all personal interests and selfish views, in order to serve under the selfless leadership of John Galt." Why are they listening? Thought Dagny. Don't they see the hallmark of death in those faces, and the hallmark of life in his? Which state do they wish to choose? Which state do they seek for mankind? She looked at the faces in the ballroom. They were nervously blank. They showed nothing but the sagging weight of lethargy and the staleness of a chronic fear. They were looking at Galt and at Mouch as if unable to perceive any difference between them or to feel concern if a difference existed. Their empty, uncritical, unvaluing stare declaring, "Who am I to know?" She shuddered, remembering his sentence. The man who declares, "Who am I to know?" is declaring, "Who am I to live?" Did they care to live? She thought. They did not seem to care even for the effort of raising that question. She saw a few faces who seemed to care. They were looking at Galt with a desperate plea, with a wistfully tragic admiration, and with hands lying limply on the tables before them. These were the men who saw what he was, who lived in frustrated longing for his world. But tomorrow, if they saw him being murdered before them, their hands would hang as limply and their eyes would look away, saying, "Who am I to act?" "Unity of action and purpose," said Mouch, "will bring us to a happier world." Mr. Thompson leaned toward Galt and whispered with an amiable smile, "You'll have to say a few words to the country later on, after me. No, not a long speech, just a sentence or two, no more. Just, hello, folks, or something like that, so they'll recognize your voice." The faintly stressed pressure of the secretary's muzzle against Galt's side added a silent paragraph. Galt did not answer. "The John Galt plan," Wesley Mouch was saying, "will reconcile all conflicts. It will protect the property of the rich and give a greater share to the poor. It will cut down the burden of your taxes and provide you with more government benefits. It will lower prices and raise wages. It will give more freedom to the individual and strengthen the bonds of collective obligations. It will combine the efficiency of free enterprise with the generosity of a planned economy. Dagny observed some faces. It took her an effort fully to believe it, who were looking at Galt with hatred. Jim was one of them, she noted. When the image of Mouch held the screen, these faces were relaxed in bored contentment, which was not pleasure, but the comfort of license, of knowing that nothing was demanded of them and nothing was firm or certain. When the camera flashed the image of Galt, their lips grew tight and their features were sharpened by a look of peculiar caution. She felt with sudden certainty that they feared the precision of his face, the unyielding clarity of his features, the look of being an entity, a look of asserting existence. They hate him for being himself, she thought, feeling a touch of cold horror as the nature of their souls became real to her. They hate him for his capacity to live. Do they want to live? She thought in self-mockery. Through the stunned numbness of her mind, she remembered the sound of his sentence, "The desire not to be anything is the desire not to be." It was now Mr. Thompson who was yelling into the microphone in his briskest and folksiest manner. "And I say to you, kick them in the teeth, all those doubters who were spreading disunity and fear. They told you that John Galt would never join us, didn't they? Well, here he is, in person, of his own free choice, at this table and at the head of our state, ready, willing, and able to serve the people's cause. Don't you ever again, any of you, start doubting or running or giving up. Tomorrow is here today, and what a tomorrow! With 3 meals a day for everyone on earth, with a car in every garage, and with electric power given free, produced by some sort of a motor the like of which we've never seen. And all you have to do is just be patient a little while longer. Patience, faith, and unity, that's the recipe for progress. We must stand united among ourselves and united with the rest of the world as a great, big, happy family, all working for the good of all. We have found a leader who will beat the record of our richest and busiest past. It's his love for mankind that has made him come here, to serve you, protect you, and take care of you. He has heard your pleas and has answered the call of our common human duty. Every man is his brother's keeper. No man is an island unto himself. And now you will hear his voice. Now you will hear his own message. Ladies and gentlemen, he said solemnly, John Galt, to the collective family of mankind. The camera moved to Galt. He remained still for a moment. Then, with so swift and expert a movement that his secretary's hand was unable to match it, he rose to his feet, leaning sidewise, leaving the pointed gun momentarily exposed to the sight of the world. Then, standing straight, facing the cameras, looking at all his invisible viewers, he said, "Get the hell out of my way." Chapter 9. The Generator. Get the hell out of my way. Dr. Robert Stadler heard it on the radio in his car. He did not know whether the next sound, part gasp, part scream, part laughter, started rising from him or from the radio, but he heard the click that cut them both off. The radio went dead. No further sounds came from the Wayne Falkland Hotel. He jerked his hand from knob to knob under the lighted dial. Nothing came through. No explanations, no pleas of technical trouble, no silence hiding music. All stations were off the air. He shuddered, He gripped the wheel, leaning forward across it like a jockey at the close of a race, and his foot pressed down on the accelerator. The small stretch of highway before him bounced with the leaping of his headlights. There was nothing beyond the lighted strip but the emptiness of the prairies of Iowa. He did not know why he had been listening to the broadcast. He did not know what made him tremble now. He chuckled abruptly. It sounded like a malevolent growl, either at the radio, or at those in the city, or at the sky. He was watching the rare posts of highway numbers. He did not need to consult a map. For 4 days that map had been printed on his brain, like a net of lines traced in acid. They could not take it away from him, he thought. They could not stop him. He felt as if he were being pursued. But there was nothing for miles behind him, except the two red lights on the rear of his car, like two small signals of danger fleeing through the darkness of the Iowa plains. The motive directing his hands and feet was 4 days behind him. It was the face of the man on the windowsill, and the faces he had confronted when he had escaped from that room. He had cried to them that he could not deal with Galt, and neither could they, that Galt would destroy them all, unless they destroyed him first. "Don't get smart, Professor," Mr. Thompson had answered coldly. "You've done an awful lot of yelling about hating his guts, but when it comes to action, you haven't helped us at all. I don't know which side you're on. If he doesn't give in to us peaceably, we might have to resort to pressure, such as hostages whom he wouldn't want to see hurt. And you're first on the list, Professor."
"I," he had screamed, shaking with terror and with bitterly desperate laughter. "I? But he damns me more than anyone on earth."
"How do I know?" Mr. Thompson had answered. "I hear that you used to be his teacher. And don't forget, you're the only one he asked for." His mind liquid with terror, he had felt as if he were about to be crushed between two walls advancing upon him. He had no chance if Galt refused to surrender, and less chance if Galt joined these men. It was then that a distant shape had come swimming forward in his mind, the image of a mushroom-domed structure in the middle of an Iowa plain. All images had begun to fuse in his mind thereafter. Project X, he had thought, not knowing whether it was the vision of that structure or of a feudal castle commanding the countryside that gave him the sense of an age and a world to which he belonged. "I'm Robert Statler," he had thought. "It's my property. It came from my discoveries. They said it was I who invented it. I'll show them," he had thought, not knowing whether he meant the man on the windowsill, or the others, or the whole of mankind. His thoughts had become like chips floating in a liquid without connections. "To seize control. I'll show them. To seize control. To rule. There is no other way to live on earth." These had been the only words that named the plan in his mind. He had felt that the rest was clear to him. Clear in the form of a savage emotion, crying defiantly that he did not have to make it clear. He would seize control of Project X, and he would rule a part of the country as his private feudal domain. The means? His emotion had answered, somehow. The motive? His mind had repeated insistently that his motive was terror of Mr. Thompson's gang, that he was not safe among them any longer, that his plan was a practical necessity. In the depth of his liquid brain, his emotions had held another kind of terror, drowned along with the connections between his broken chips of words. These chips had been the only compass directing his course through 4 days and nights, while he drove down deserted highways, across a country collapsing into chaos, while he developed a monomaniac's cunning for obtaining illegal purchases of gas, while he snatched random hours of restless sleep in obscure motels under assumed names. "I'm Robert Statler," he had thought, his mind repeating it as a formula of omnipotence.
To seize control, he had thought, speeding against the futile traffic lights of half-abandoned towns, speeding on the vibrating steel of the Taggart Bridge across the Mississippi, speeding past the occasional ruins of farms in the empty stretches of Iowa. I'll show them, he had thought. Let them pursue. They won't stop me this time. He had thought it, even though no one had pursued him, as no one was pursuing him now but the taillights of his own car and the motive drowned in his mind. He looked at his silent radio and chuckled. The chuckle had the emotional quality of a fist being shaken at space. It's I who am practical, he thought. I have no choice. I have no other way. I'll show all those insolent gangsters who forget that I am Robert Stadler. They will all collapse, but I won't. I'll survive. I'll win. I'll show them. The words were like chunks of solid ground in his mind, in the midst of a fiercely silent swamp. The connections lay submerged at the bottom. If connected, his words would have formed the sentence, I'll show him that there is no other way to live on Earth. The scattered lights in the distance ahead were the barracks erected on the site of Project X, now known as Harmony City. He observed, as he came closer, that something out of the ordinary was going on at Project X. The barbed wire fence was broken, and no sentinels met him at the gate. But some sort of abnormal activity was churning in the patches of darkness and in the glare of some wavering spotlights. There were armored trucks and running figures and shouted orders and the gleam of bayonets. No one stopped his car. At the corner of a shanty, he saw the motionless body of a soldier sprawled on the ground. Drunk, he thought, preferring to think it, wondering why he felt unsure of it. The mushroom structure crouched on a knoll before him. There were lights in the narrow slits of its windows, and the shapeless funnels protruded from under its dome, aimed at the darkness of the country. A soldier barred his way when he alighted from his car at the entrance. The soldier was properly armed, but hatless, and his uniform seemed too sloppy. "Where are you going, bud?" he asked. "Let me in," Dr. Stadler ordered contemptuously. "What's your business here?" "I'm Dr. Robert Stadler."
"I'm Joe Blow. I said, what's your business? Are you one of the new or one of the old?"
"Let me in, you idiot. I'm Dr. Robert Stadler."
It was not the name, but the tone of voice and the form of address that seemed to convince the soldier.
"One of the new," he said, and opening the door, shouted to somebody inside, "Hey, Mac, take care of Grandpa here. See what he wants."
In the bare, dim hall of reinforced concrete, he was met by a man who might have been an officer, except that his tunic was open at the throat and a cigarette hung insolently in the corner of his mouth.
"Who are you?"
he snapped, his hand jerking too swiftly to the holster on his hip.
"I'm Dr. Robert Stadler."
The name had no effect.
"Who gave you permission to come here?"
"I need no permission."
This seemed to have an effect. The man removed the cigarette from his mouth.
"Who sent for you?"
he asked, a shade uncertainly.
"Will you please let me speak to the commandant?" Dr. Stadler demanded impatiently.
"The commandant? You're too late, brother."
"The chief engineer, then."
"The chief who?" "Oh, Willie. Willie's okay, he's one of us, but he's out on an errand just now."
There were other figures in the hall, listening with an apprehensive curiosity. The officer's hand summoned one of them to approach, an unshaved civilian with a shabby overcoat thrown over his shoulders.
"What do you want?" he snapped at Stadler.
"Would someone please tell me where are the gentlemen of the scientific staff?"
Dr. Stadler asked in the courteously peremptory tone of an order. The two men glanced at each other, as if such a question were irrelevant in this place.
"Do you come from Washington?" the civilian asked suspiciously. "I do not. I will have you understand that I'm through with that Washington gang."
Oh. The man seemed pleased. Are you a friend of the people, then?
I would say that I'm the best friend the people ever had. I'm the man who gave them all this.
He pointed around him.
You did, said the man, impressed. Are you one of those who made a deal with the boss?
I'm the boss here from now on.
The men looked at each other, retreating a few steps. The officer asked,
Did you say the name was Stadler?
Robert Stadler. And if you don't know what that means, you'll find out.
Will you please follow me, sir? Said the officer, with shaky politeness.
What happened next was not clear to Dr. Stadler, because his mind refused to admit the reality of the things he was seeing. There were shifting figures in half-lighted, disordered offices. There were too many firearms on everybody's hips. There were senseless questions asked of him by jerky voices that alternated between impertinence and fear. He did not know whether any of them tried to give him an explanation. He would not listen. He could not permit this to be true. He kept stating in the tone of a feudal sovereign, I'm the boss here from now on. I give the orders. I came to take over. I own this place. I am Dr. Robert Stadler. And if you don't know that name in this place, you have no business being here, you infernal idiots. You'll blow yourselves to pieces if that's the state of your knowledge. Have you had a high school course in physics? You don't look to me as if you've ever been allowed inside a high school, any of you. What are you doing here? Who are you? It took him a long time to grasp, when his mind could not block it any longer, that somebody had beaten him to his plan. Somebody had held the same view of existence as his own and had set out to achieve the same future. He grasped that these men, who called themselves the friends of the people, had seized possession of Project X tonight, a few hours ago, intending to establish a reign of their own. He laughed in their faces with bitterly incredulous contempt.
You don't know what you're doing, you miserable juvenile delinquents. Do you think that you can handle a high-precision instrument of science? Who is your leader? I demand to see your leader.
It was his tone of overbearing authority, his contempt and their own panic, the blind panic of men of unbridled violence, who have no standards of safety or danger, that made them waver and wonder whether he was perhaps some secret top-level member of their leadership. They were equally ready to defy or to obey any authority. After being shunted from one jittery commander to another, he found himself at last being led down iron stairways and down long, echoing underground corridors of reinforced concrete to an audience with the boss in person. The boss had taken refuge in the underground control room. Among the complex spirals of the delicate scientific machinery that produced the sound ray, against the wall panel of glittering levers, dials, and gauges, known as the xylophone, Robert Stadler faced the new ruler of Project X. It was Cuffy Meggs. He wore a tight, semi-military tunic and leather leggings. The flesh of his neck bulged over the edge of his collar. His black curls were matted with sweat. He was pacing restlessly, unsteadily in front of the xylophone, shouting orders to men who kept rushing in and out of the room.
Send couriers to every county seat within our reach. Tell them that the friends of the people have won. Tell them they're not to take orders from Washington any longer. The new capital of the People's Commonwealth is Harmony City, henceforth to be known as Meggsville. Tell them that I'll expect $500,000 per every 5,000 heads of population by tomorrow morning, or else.
It took some time before Cuffy Meg's attention and bleary brown eyes could be drawn to focus on the person of Dr. Stadler.
Well, what is it? What is it? He snapped.
I am Dr. Robert Stadler.
Huh? Oh, yeah. You're the big guy from outer spaces, aren't you?
You're the fellow who catches atoms or something. Well, what on earth are you doing here?
It is I who should ask you that question.
Huh? Look, Professor, I'm in no mood for jokes.
I have come here to take control.
Control? Of what?
Of this equipment, of this place, of the countryside within its radius of operation.
Meg stared at him blankly for a moment, then asked softly, How did you get here?
By car.
I mean, whom did you bring with you?
Nobody.
What weapons did you bring?
None. My name is sufficient.
You came here alone, with your name and your car.
I did.
Cuffy Meggs burst out laughing in his face.
Do you think, asked Dr. Stadler, that you can operate an installation of this kind?
Run along, Professor, run along. Beat it before I have you shot. We've got no use for intellectuals around here.
How much do you know about this?
Dr. Stadler pointed at the xylophone. Who cares? Technicians are a dime a dozen these days.
Beat it.
This ain't Washington. I'm through with those impractical dreamers in Washington. They won't get anywhere bargaining with that radio ghost and making speeches.
Action. That's what's needed. Direct action.
Beat it, Doc. Your day is over. He was weaving unsteadily back and forth, catching at a lever of the xylophone once in a while. Dr. Stadler realized that Meggs was drunk.
Don't touch those levers, you fool.
Meggs jerked his hand back involuntarily, then waved it defiantly at the panel.
I'll touch anything I please. Don't you tell me what to do. Get away from that panel. Get out of here. This is mine. Do you understand? It's my property.
Property? Huh! Meggs gave a brief bark that was a chuckle.
I invented it. I created it. I made it possible.
You did? Well, many thanks, Doc. Many thanks, but we don't need you any longer. We've got our own mechanics.
Have you any idea what I had to know in order to make it possible? You couldn't think of a single tube of it. Not a single bolt.
Meg shrugged.
Maybe not. Then how dare you think that you can own it? How dare you come here? What claim do you have to it?
Meggs patted his holster.
This. Listen, you drunken lout, cried Dr. Stadler. Do you know what you're playing with?
Don't you talk to me like that, you old fool. Who are you to talk to me like that? I can break your neck with my bare hands. Don't you know who I am?
You're a scared thug way out of his depth.
Oh, I am I?
I'm the boss. I'm the boss, and I'm not going to be stopped by an old scarecrow like you.
Get out of here. They stood staring at each other for a moment by the panel of the xylophone, both cornered by terror. The unadmitted root of Dr. Stadler's terror was his frantic struggle not to acknowledge that he was looking at his final product, that this was his spiritual son. Cuffy Meg's terror had wider roots. It embraced all of existence. He had lived in chronic terror all his life, but now he was struggling not to acknowledge what it was that he had dreaded. In the moment of his triumph, when he expected to be safe, that mysterious occult breed, the intellectual, was refusing to fear him and defying his power.
"Get out of here," snarled Cuffy Meg's. I'll call my men. I'll have you shot.
Get out of here, you lousy, brainless, swaggering moron, snarled Dr. Stadler.
Do you think I'll let you cash in on my life? Do you think it's for you that I sold?
He did not finish.
Stop touching those levers, goddamn you. Don't you give me orders. I don't need you to tell me what to do. You're not going to scare me with your classy mumbo-jumbo. I'll do as I please. What did I fight for if I can't do as I please?
He chuckled and reached for a lever.
Hey, Cuffy, take it easy,
yelled some figure in the back of the room, darting forward.
Stand back, roared Cuffy Meggs. Stand back, all of you.
Scared, am I?
I'll show you who's boss.
Dr. Stadler leaped to stop him, but Meggs shoved him aside with one arm, gave a gulp of laughter at the sight of Stadler falling to the floor, and with the other arm, yanked a lever of the xylophone. The crash of sound, the screeching crash of ripped metal and of pressures colliding on conflicting circuits, the sound of a monster turning upon itself, was heard only inside the structure. No sound was heard outside. Outside, the structure merely rose into the air, suddenly and silently, cracked open into a few large pieces, shot some hissing streaks of blue light to the sky, and came down as a pile of rubble. Within the circle of a radius of 100 miles, enclosing parts of 4 states, telegraph poles fell like matchsticks, farmhouses collapsed into chips, city buildings went down as if slashed and minced by a single second's blow, with no time for a sound to be heard by the twisted bodies of the victims. And on the circle's periphery, halfway across the Mississippi, the engine and the first 6 cars of a passenger train flew as a shower of metal into the water of the river, along with the western spans of the Taggart Bridge, cut in half. On the site of what had once been Project X, nothing remained alive among the ruins, except, for some endless minutes longer, a huddle of torn flesh and screaming pain that had once been a great mine. There was a sense of weightless freedom, thought Dagny, in the feeling that a telephone booth was her only immediate, absolute goal, with no concern for any of the goals of the passers-by in the streets around her. It did not make her feel estranged from the city. It made her feel, for the first time, that she owned the city, and that she loved it, that she had never loved it before as she did in this moment, with so personal, solemn, and confident a sense of possession. The night was still and clear. She looked at the sky. As her feeling was more solemn than joyous, but held the sense of a future joy, so the air was more windless than warm, but held the hint of a distant spring. Get the hell out of my way, she thought, not with resentment, but almost with amusement, with a sense of detachment and deliverance, addressing it to the passers-by, to the traffic when it impeded her hurried progress, and to any fear she had known in the past. It was less than an hour ago that she had heard him utter that sentence, and his voice still seemed to ring in the air of the streets, merging into a distant hint of laughter. She had laughed exultantly in the ballroom of the Wayne Falkland when she had heard him say it. She had laughed, her hand pressed to her mouth, so that the laughter was only in her eyes and in his, when he had looked straight at her and she had known that he heard it. They had looked at each other for the span of a second, above the heads of the gasping, screaming crowd, above the crash of the microphones being shattered, though all stations had been instantly cut off, above the bursts of breaking glass on falling tables, as some people went stampeding to the doors. Then she had heard Mr. Thompson cry, waving his arm at Galt, "Take him back to his room, but guard him with your lives!" And the crowd had parted as 3 men led him out. Mr. Thompson seemed to collapse for a moment, dropping his forehead on his arm, but he rallied, jumped to his feet, waved vaguely at his henchmen to follow, and rushed out through a private side exit. No one addressed or instructed the guests. Some were running blindly to escape, others sat still, not daring to move. The ballroom was like a ship without captain. She cut through the crowd and followed the click. No one tried to stop her. She found them huddled in a small private study. Mr. Thompson was slumped in an armchair, clutching his head with both hands. Wesley Mouch was moaning. Eugene Lawson was sobbing with the sound of a nasty child's rage. Jim was watching the others with an oddly expectant intensity.
"I told you so," Dr. Ferris was shouting. "I told you so, didn't I? That's where you get with your peaceful persuasion."
She remained standing by the door. They seemed to notice her presence, but they did not seem to care.
"I resign," yelled Chick Morrison. "I resign. I'm through. I don't know what to say to the country. I can't think. I won't try. It's no use. I couldn't help it. You're not going to blame me. I've resigned."
He waved his arms in some shapeless gesture of futility or farewell and ran out of the room.
"He has a hideout all stocked for himself in Tennessee," said Tinky Holloway reflectively, as if he too had taken a similar precaution and were now wondering whether the time had come.
"He won't keep it for long if he gets there at all," said Mouch.
"With the gangs of raiders and the state of transportation?" He spread his hands and did not finish. She knew what thoughts were filling the pause. She knew that no matter what private escapes these men had once provided for themselves, they were now grasping the fact that all of them were trapped. She observed that there was no terror in their faces. She saw hints of it, but it looked like a perfunctory terror. Their expressions ranged from blank apathy to the relieved look of cheats who had believed that the game could end no other way and were making no effort to contest it or regret it, to the petulant blindness of Lawson, who refused to be conscious of anything, to the peculiar intensity of Jim, whose face suggested a secret smile.
"Well?"
"Well?" Dr. Ferris was asking impatiently, with the crackling energy of a man who feels at home in a world of hysteria.
"What are you now going to do with him? Argue? Debate? Make speeches?"
No one answered.
"He has to save us," said Mouch slowly, as if straining the last of his mind into blankness and delivering an ultimatum to reality. "He has to take over and save the system."
"Why don't you write him a love letter about it?" said Ferris.
"We've got to make him take over. We've got to force him to rule," said Mouch in the tone of a sleepwalker.
"Now," said Ferris, suddenly dropping his voice, "do you see what a valuable establishment the State Science Institute really is?"
Mouch did not answer him, but she observed that they all seemed to know what he meant.
"You objected to that private research project of mine as impractical," said Ferris softly. "But what did I tell you?"
Mouch did not answer. He was cracking his knuckles.
"This is no time for squeamishness," James Taggart spoke up with unexpected vigor, but his voice too was oddly low. "We don't have to be sissies about it."
"It seems to me," said Mouch dully, that the end justifies the means."
"It's too late for any scruples or any principles," said Ferris. "Only direct action can work now."
No one answered. They were acting as if they wished that their pauses, not their words, would state what they were discussing.
"It won't work," said Tinky Holloway. "He won't give in."
"That's what you think," said Ferris, and chuckled.
"You haven't seen our experimental model in action. Last month, we got 3 confessions in 3 unsolved murder cases."
"If," started Mr. Thompson, and his voice cracked suddenly into a moan,
"if he dies, we all perish."
"Don't worry," said Ferris. "He won't."
The Ferris persuader is safely calculated against that possibility. Mr. Thompson did not answer.
"It seems to me that we have no other choice," said Mouch.
It was almost a whisper. They remained silent. Mr. Thompson was struggling not to see that they were all looking at him.
Then he cried suddenly, "Oh, do anything you want. I couldn't help it. Do anything you want."
Dr. Ferris turned to Lawson. "Jean," he said tensely, still whispering, "run to the radio control office. Order all stations to stand by. Tell them that I'll have Mr. Gault on the air within 3 hours.
Lawson leaped to his feet with a sudden mirthful grin and ran out of the room.
She knew. She knew what they intended doing and what it was within them that made it possible. They did not think that this would succeed. They did not think that Gault would give in. They did not want him to give in. They did not think that anything could save them now. They did not want to be saved. Moved by the panic of their nameless emotions, they had fought against reality all their lives, and now they had reached a moment when at last they felt at home. They did not have to know why they felt it, they who had chosen never to know what they felt. They merely experienced a sense of recognition, since this was what they had been seeking. This was the kind of reality that had been implied in all of their feelings, their actions, their desires, their choices, their dreams. This was the nature and the method of the rebellion against existence and of the undefined quest for an unnamed nirvana. They did not want to live. They wanted him to die. The horror she felt was only a brief stab, like the wrench of a switching perspective. She grasped that the objects she had thought to be human were not. She was left with a sense of clarity, of a final answer, and of the need to act. He was in danger. There was no time and no room in her consciousness to waste emotion on the actions of the subhuman.
"We must make sure," Wesley Mouch was whispering, "that nobody ever learns about it."
"Nobody will," said Ferris. Their voices had the cautious drone of conspirators. "It's a secret, separate unit on the Institute grounds, soundproofed and safely distant from the rest. Only a very few of our staff have ever entered it."
"If we were to fly," said Mouch,
and stopped abruptly, as if he had caught some warning in Ferris' face. She saw Ferris' eyes move to her, as if he had suddenly remembered her presence. She held his glance, letting him see the untroubled indifference of hers, as if she had neither cared nor understood. Then, as if merely grasping the signal of a private discussion, she turned slowly, with the suggestion of a shrug, and left the room. She knew that they were now past the stage of worrying about her. She walked with the same unhurried indifference through the halls and through the exit of the hotel. But a block away, when she had turned a corner, her head flew up and the folds of her evening gown slammed like a sail against her legs with the sudden violence of the speed of her steps. And now, as she rushed through the darkness, thinking only of finding a telephone booth, she felt a new sensation rising irresistibly within her, past the immediate tension of danger and concern. It was the sense of freedom of a world that had never had to be obstructed. She saw the wedge of light on the sidewalk that came from the window of a bar. No one gave her a second glance as she crossed the half-deserted room. The few customers were still waiting and whispering tensely in front of the crackling blue void of an empty television screen. Standing in the tight space of the telephone booth, as in the cabin of a ship about to take off for a different planet, she dialed the number, Oregon 65693. The voice that answered at once was Francisco's.
"Hello." "Francisco?"
"Hello, Dagny. I was expecting you to call."
"Did you hear the broadcast?"
"I did."
"They are now planning to force him to give in."
She kept her voice to the tone of a factual report.
"They intend to torture him. They have some machine called the Ferris Persuader, in an isolated unit on the grounds of the State Science Institute. It's in New Hampshire. They mentioned flying. They mentioned that they would have him on the radio within 3 hours.
"I see. Are you calling from a public phone booth?"
"Yes."
"You're still in evening clothes, aren't you?"
"Yes."
"Now listen carefully. Go home. Change your clothes, pack a few things you'll need, take your jewelry and any valuables that you can carry, take some warm clothing.
We won't have time to do it later. Meet me in 40 minutes on the northwest corner, 2 blocks east of the main entrance of the Taggart Terminal.
Right.
So long, Slug.
So long, Frisco.
She was in the bedroom of her apartment in less than 5 minutes, tearing off her evening gown. She left it lying in the middle of the floor, like the discarded uniform of an army she was not serving any longer. She put on a dark blue suit and, remembering Galt's words, a white, high-collared sweater. She packed a suitcase and a bag with a strap that she could carry swung over her shoulder. She put her jewelry in a corner of the bag, including the bracelet of Reardon metal she had earned in the outside world, and the $5 gold piece she had earned in the valley. It was easy to leave the apartment and to lock the door, even though she knew she would probably never open it again. It seemed harder for a moment when she came to her office. No one had seen her come in. The anteroom of her office was empty. The great Taggart building seemed unusually quiet. She stood looking for a moment at this room and at all the years it had contained. Then she smiled. No, it was not too hard, she thought. She opened her safe and took the documents she had come here to get. There was nothing else that she wanted to take from her office, except the picture of Nathaniel Taggart and the map of Taggart Transcontinental. She broke the 2 frames, folded the picture and the map, and slipped them into her suitcase. She was locking the suitcase when she heard the sound of hurrying steps. The door flew open and the chief engineer rushed in. He was shaking. His face was distorted.
"Miss Taggart," he cried. "Oh, thank God, Miss Taggart, you're here. We've been calling for you all over."
She did not answer. She looked at him inquiringly.
"Miss Taggart, have you heard?"
"What?"
"Then you haven't. Oh, God, Miss Taggart, it's... I can't believe it. I still can't believe it, but... Oh, God, what are we going to do? The Taggart Bridge is gone."
She stared at him, unable to move.
"It's gone. Blown up. Blown up, apparently, in 1 second. Nobody knows for certain what happened. But it looks like... They think that something went wrong at Project X, and... It looks like those sound rays, Miss Taggart. We can't get through to any point within a radius of 100 miles. It's not possible, it can't be possible, but it looks as if everything in that circle has been wiped out. We can't get any answers. Nobody can get an answer. The newspapers, the radio stations, the police. We're still checking, but the stories that are coming from the rim of that circle are..."
He shuddered.
"Only one thing is certain. The bridge is gone. Miss Taggart, we don't know what to do."
She leaped to her desk and seized the telephone receiver. Her hand stopped in midair. Then slowly, twistedly, with the greatest effort ever demanded of her, she began to move her arm down to place the receiver back. It seemed to her that it took a long time, as if her arm had to move against some atmospheric pressure that no human body could combat. And in the span of these few brief moments, in the stillness of a blinding pain, she knew what Francisco had felt that night 12 years ago, and what a boy of 26 had felt when he had looked at his motor for the last time.
"Miss Taggart," cried the chief engineer, "we don't know what to do."
The receiver clicked softly back into its cradle.
"I don't either," she answered.
In a moment she knew it was over. She heard her voice telling the man to check further and report to her later, and she waited for the sound of his steps to vanish in the echoing silence of the hall. Crossing the concourse of the terminal for the last time, she glanced at the statue of Nathaniel Taggart and remembered a promise she had made. It would be only a symbol now, she thought, but it would be the kind of farewell that Nathaniel Taggart deserved. She had no other writing instrument. So she took the lipstick from her bag and, smiling up at the marble face of the man who would have understood, she drew a large sign of the dollar on the pedestal under his feet. She was first to reach the corner, 2 blocks east of the terminal entrance. As she waited, she observed the first trickles of the panic that was soon to engulf the city.
There were automobiles driving too fast, some of them loaded with household effects. There were too many police cars speeding by, and too many sirens bursting in the distance. The news of the destruction of the bridge was apparently spreading through the city. They would know that the city was doomed, and they would start a stampede to escape. But they had no place to go, and it was not her concern any longer. She saw Francisco's figure approaching from some distance away. She recognized the swiftness of his walk before she could distinguish the face under the cap pulled low over his eyes. She caught the moment when he saw her as he came closer. He waved his arm with a smile of greeting. Some conscious stress in the sweep of his arm made it the gesture of a Danconia, welcoming the arrival of a long-awaited traveler at the gates of his own domain. When he approached, she stood solemnly straight and, looking at his face, and at the buildings of the greatest city in the world, as at the kind of witnesses she wanted, she said slowly, her voice confident and steady, "I swear, by my life and my love of it, that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine." He inclined his head, as if in sign of admittance. His smile was now a salute. Then he took her suitcase with one hand, her arm with the other, and said, "Come on." The unit known as Project F, in honor of its originator, Dr. Ferris, was a small structure of reinforced concrete, low on the slope of the hill that supported the State Science Institute on a higher, more public level. Only the small gray patch of the unit's roof could be seen from the Institute's windows, hidden in a jungle of ancient trees. It looked no bigger than the cover of a manhole. The unit consisted of two stories in the shape of a small cube placed asymmetrically on top of a larger one. The first story had no windows, only a door studded with iron spikes. The second story had but one window, as if in reluctant concession to daylight, like a face with a single eye. The men on the staff of the Institute felt no curiosity about that structure and avoided the paths that led down to its door. Nobody had ever suggested it, but they had the impression that the structure housed a project devoted to experiments with the germs of deadly diseases. The two floors were occupied by laboratories that contained a great many cages with guinea pigs, dogs, and rats. But the heart and meaning of the structure was a room in its cellar, deep under the ground. The room had been incompetently lined with the porous sheets of soundproofing material. The sheets had begun to crack, and the naked rock of a cave showed through. The unit was always protected by a squad of 4 special guards. Tonight the squad had been augmented to 16, summoned for emergency duty by a long-distance telephone call from New York. The guards, as well as all other employees of Project F, had been carefully chosen on the basis of a single qualification: an unlimited capacity for obedience. The 16 were stationed for the night outside the structure and in the deserted laboratories above the ground, where they remained uncritically on duty, with no curiosity about anything that might be taking place below. In the cellar room under the ground, Dr. Ferris, Wesley Mouch, and James Taggart sat in armchairs lined up against one wall. A machine that looked like a small cabinet of irregular shape stood in a corner across from them. Its face bore rows of glass dials, each dial marked by a segment of red, a square screen that looked like an amplifier, rows of numbers, rows of wooden knobs and plastic buttons, a single lever controlling a switch at one side, and a single red glass button at the other. The face of the machine seemed to have more expression than the face of the mechanic in charge of it. He was a husky young man in a sweat-stained shirt with sleeves rolled above the elbows. His pale blue eyes were glazed by an enormously conscientious concentration on his task. He moved his lips once in a while, as if reciting a memorized lesson. A short wire led from the machine to an electric storage battery behind it. Long coils of wire, like the twisted arms of an octopus, stretched forward across the stone floor, from the machine to a leather mattress spread under a cone of violet light. John Galt lay strapped to the mattress. He was naked. The small metal discs of electrodes at the ends of the wires were attached to his wrists, his shoulders, his hips, and his ankles. A device resembling a stethoscope was attached to his chest and connected to the amplifier.
"Get this straight," said Dr. Ferris, addressing him for the first time. "We want you to take full power over the economy of the country. We want you to become a dictator. We want you to rule. Understand? We want you to give orders and to figure out the right orders to give. What we want, we mean to get. Speeches, logic, arguments, or passive obedience won't save you now. We want ideas, or else. We won't let you out of here until you tell us the exact measures you'll take to save our system. Then we'll have you tell it to the country over the radio." He raised his wrist, displaying a stopwatch. "I'll give you 30 seconds to decide whether you want to start talking right now. If not, then we'll start. Do you understand?" Galt was looking straight at them, his face expressionless, as if he understood too much. He did not answer. They heard the sound of the stopwatch in the silence, counting off the seconds, and the sound of Mouch's choked, irregular breathing as he gripped the arms of his chair. Ferris waved a signal to the mechanic at the machine. The mechanic threw the switch. It lighted the red glass button and set off two sounds. One was the low, humming drone of an electric generator. The other was a peculiar beat, as regular as the ticking of a clock, but with an oddly muffled resonance. It took them a moment to realize that it came from the amplifier and that they were hearing the beat of Galt's heart. "Number 3, said Ferris, raising a finger in signal. The mechanic pressed a button under one of the dials. A long shudder ran through Galt's body. His left arm shook in jerking spasms, convulsed by the electric current that circled between his wrist and shoulder. His head fell back, his eyes closed, his lips drawn tight. He made no sound. When the mechanic lifted his finger off the button, Galt's arm stopped shaking. He did not move. The three men glanced about them with an instant's look of groping. Ferris' eyes were blank, Mouch's terrified, Taggart's disappointed. The sound of the thumping beat went on through the silence. "Number 2, said Ferris. It was Galt's right leg that twisted in convulsions, with the current now circling between his hip and ankle. His hands gripped the edges of the mattress. His head jerked once from side to side, then lay still. The beating of the heart grew faintly faster. Mouch was drawing away, pressing against the back of his armchair. Taggart was sitting on the edge of his, leaning forward. "Number 1, gradual," said Ferris. Galt's torso jerked upward and fell back and twisted in long shudders, straining against his strapped wrists, as the current was now running from his one wrist to the other, across his lungs. The mechanic was slowly turning a knob, increasing the voltage of the current. The needle on the dial was moving toward the red segment that marked danger. Galt's breath was coming in broken, panting sounds out of convulsed lungs. "Had enough?" snarled Ferris when the current went off. Galt did not answer. His lips moved faintly, opening for air. The beat from the stethoscope was racing, but his breath was falling to an even rhythm, by a controlled effort at relaxation. "You're too easy on him," yelled Taggart, staring at the naked body on the mattress. Galt opened his eyes and glanced at them for a moment. They could tell nothing, except that his glance was steady and fully conscious. Then he dropped his head again and lay still, as if he had forgotten them. His naked body looked strangely out of place in this cellar. They knew it, though none of them would identify that knowledge. The long lines of his body, running from his ankles to the flat hips, to the angle of his waist, to the straight shoulders, looked like a statue of ancient Greece, sharing that statue's meaning, but stylized to a longer, lighter, more active form and a gaunter strength, suggesting more restless and energy. The body, not of a chariot driver, but of a builder of airplanes. And as the meaning of a statue of ancient Greece,
the statue of man as a god, clashed with the spirit of this century's halls, so his body clashed with a cellar devoted to prehistorical activities. The clash was the greater because he seemed to belong with electric wires, with stainless steel, with precision instruments, with the levers of a control board. Perhaps this was the thought most fiercely resisted and most deeply buried at the bottom of his watcher's sensations, the thought they knew only as a diffused hatred and an unfocused terror. Perhaps it was the absence of such statues from the modern world that had transformed a generator into an octopus and brought a body such as his into its tentacles. "I understand you're some sort of electrical expert," said Ferris, and chuckled. "So are we. Don't you think so?" Two sounds answered him in the silence, the drone of the generator and the beating of Galt's heart. "The mixed series," ordered Ferris, waving one finger at the mechanic. The shocks now came at irregular, unpredictable intervals, one after another or minutes apart. Only the shuddering convulsions of Galt's legs, arms, torso, or entire body showed whether the current was racing between two particular electrodes or through all of them at once. The needles on the dials kept coming close to the red marks, then receding. The machine was calculated to inflict the maximum intensity of pain without damaging the body of the victim. It was the watchers who found it unbearable to wait through the minutes of the pauses filled with the sound of the heartbeat. The heart was now racing in an irregular rhythm. The pauses were calculated to let that beat slow down, but allow no relief to the victim, who had to wait for a shock at any moment. Galt lay relaxed, as if not attempting to fight the pain, but surrendering to it, not attempting to negate it, but to bear it. When his lips parted for breath and a sudden jolt slammed them tight again, he did not resist the shaking rigidity of his body, but he let it vanish the instant the current left him. Only the skin of his face was pulled tight, and the sealed line of his lips twisted sidewise once in a while. When a shock raced through his chest, the gold-copper strands of his hair flew with the jerking of his head, as if waving in a gust of wind, beating against his face, across his eyes. The watchers wondered why his hair seemed to be growing darker, until they realized that it was drenched in sweat. The terror of hearing one's own heart struggling as if about to burst at any moment had been intended to be felt by the victim. It was the torturers who were trembling with terror as they listened to the jagged, broken rhythm and missed a breath with every missing beat. It sounded now as if the heart were leaping, beating frantically against its cage of ribs, in agony and in a desperate anger. The heart was protesting. The man would not. He lay still, his eyes closed, his hands relaxed, hearing his heart as it fought for his life. Wesley Mouch was first to break.
"Oh, God, Floyd," he screamed. "Don't kill him. Don't dare kill him. If he dies, we die."
"He won't," snarled Ferris. "He'll wish he had, but he won't. The machine won't let him. It's mathematically computed. It's safe."
"Oh, isn't it enough? He'll obey us now. I'm sure he'll obey."
"No, it's not enough. I don't want him to obey. I want him to believe, to accept, to want to accept. We've got to have him work for us voluntarily."
"Go ahead," cried Taggart. "What are you waiting for? Can't you make the current stronger? He hasn't even screamed yet."
"What's the matter with you?" gasped Mouch, catching a glimpse of Taggart's face while the current was twisting Galt's body. Taggart was staring at it intently, yet his eyes seemed glazed and dead. But around that inanimate stare, the muscles of his face were pulled into an obscene caricature of enjoyment.
"Had enough," Ferris kept yelling to Galt. "Are you ready to want what we want?"
They heard no answer. Galt raised his head once in a while and looked at them. There were dark rings under his eyes, but the eyes were clear and conscious. In mounting panic, the watchers lost their sense of context and language, and their three voices blended into a progression of indiscriminate shrieks.
"We want you to take over.
We want you to rule. We order you to give orders.
We demand that you dictate. We order that you save us. We order you to think.
They heard no answer but the beating of the heart on which their own lives depended. The current was shooting through Galt's chest, and the beating was coming in irregular spurts, as if it were racing and stumbling, when suddenly his body fell still, relaxing. The beating had stopped. The silence was like a stunning blow, and before they had time to scream, their horror was topped by another, by the fact that Galt opened his eyes and raised his head. Then they realized that the drone of the motor had ceased too, and that the red light had gone out on the control panel. The current had stopped. The generator was dead. The mechanic was jabbing his finger at the button to no avail. He yanked the lever of the switch again and again. He kicked the side of the machine. The red light would not go on. The sound did not return.
Well? Snapped Ferris.